Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, your show about America's parks and public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities, coming to you actually tonight, taping this late on a rainy spring evening up at altitude. It is just chilly enough to be really nice outside. On the show, we are diving into state conservation policies. What happened at the state legislatures in Colorado and Montana this year? We will talk to folks from Montana Conservation Voters and Conservation Colorado about how things went. Plus, did the eccentric billionaire Howard Hughes leave behind a secret will to help out a guy who once rescued him in the Nevada desert? We will look back at one of the weirdest trials of the 20th century, this week in Western history. And before we get to the news, a quick announcement for those of you in Colorado. Interior Secretary David Bernhardt, who is theoretically a Coloradan, is going to be in Vail this coming Monday, June 10th. He's going to be on stage at the Western Governors Association annual meeting, and folks in Eagle County, along with some of our friends from the Sierra Club and Conservation Colorado, are going to be there to remind him what real Colorado residents think of his policies. The rally will kick off at Donovan Park in Vail at 11:30 a.m. again this coming Monday, June 10th. Folks will march to a spot near the hotel where Bernhardt is speaking. And of course, it wouldn't be a real Colorado protest without free beer and pizza afterwards. I'm sure there will be some swamp creatures there in attendance. I will be there too, not wearing a mask, so please say hi if you make it. Also, big thanks to everyone who wrote in after our last episode with ideas for our summer podcast tour. We have some great suggestions in already for who to talk to and where to go, especially in New Mexico and Montana. The planning for all of this is very much underway, so if you're in any of those other Western states and you want us to come do a podcast where you are, please drop us an email, podcast@westernpriorities.org. All right. On to the news. The big headline this week, the Grand Canyon in the crosshairs. The Trump administration released a new roadmap for what it calls critical minerals for national security. Uranium is now on that list of minerals, and the official government strategy might as well put a flashing neon sign over the Grand Canyon that says, "Uranium companies, get ready to dig here." First off, the roadmap orders a review of every single mineral withdrawal that is already in effect across the country, and it gives priorities to area where there is high mineral potential. Now, since areas along both the south and north rims of the Grand Canyon already have one active uranium mine, one mine on standby, three cleanup sites, and three more proposed mines, it is safe to say that the Grand Canyon would be at the top of that list. The new plan also requires land managers to identify areas with high mineral potential before they can recommend any land use designation that would restrict mining. And that could apply to all of the land that President Trump is trying to remove from Bear's Ears. Also could apply to land near arches and canyon lands that have potash deposits. And then the plan would require travel management plans for public lands that, quote, facilitate access for exploration and development of minerals. That is a clear giveaway to Energy Fuels Resources, which pushed for the reductions of the Bear's Ears boundaries so that it could get to its mining claims in southern Utah. All of this is part of an industry wish list that has been put down in writing. We've read it all. Before Andrew Wheeler became the EPA administrator, he lobbied on behalf of Energy Fuels Resources on Bear's Ears specifically. Interior Secretary David Bernhardt did work for uranium, potash, and copper companies, and after he became deputy secretary, he met with the National Mining Association at least three times that we know of, and all three of those meetings were hidden on his public calendars. We only know about them because Interior was forced to release those separate calendars, his so-called daily cards, that were kept in a Google document that was being overwritten at the end of each day. And in the time since David Bernhardt took over as acting and then full Interior Secretary, the department has released five different versions of his calendars, and they all show different things. There is no definitive version of David Bernhardt's schedule. CNN just put up a deep dive into all of that. It's in the show notes. They found 88 entries in his daily cards just from the last couple months that describe meetings simply as external or intergovernmental with no extra details. The takeaway, and I pointed this out to CNN in that story, is that it's not just sloppy record keeping or a lack of transparency. It's that David Bernhardt keeps taking active steps to conceal his actions. It's not only that we don't know who he's meeting with, it's that we don't know what his meetings are about. And remember, no one keeps a day planner that only says internal briefing and external meeting with no details. If you or I did that, we couldn't get through our day. But David Bernhardt keeps playing this shell game because it helps him get away with doing favors for his former clients, like paving the way for a uranium boom at the Grand Canyon. Now, I didn't even get into the risks of what happens if uranium mining starts up again. We did a great episode with Amber Raimondo and Roger Clark from Grand Canyon Trust. You go back 27 episodes in this feed. It is from January 2018. There's also a link to the show notes, which may be quicker than trying to count back 27 episodes. That is a must listen to understand the toxic legacy that uranium companies left behind at the Grand Canyon the first time around. We spend a whole lot of time on this podcast talking about playing defense, stopping or slowing the Trump administration's attack on America's public lands and their denial of climate science. But while the federal government may be sliding backwards, state governments are stepping up to lead the way, even in quote-unquote red states like Montana. State legislatures across the West are wrapping up their legislative sessions right now, and don't worry, we are going to look at many more of them over the next few months. But I wanted to start in Colorado and Montana. On the line, we've got Jessica Goad, Deputy Director at Conservation Colorado.
Hi there.
And also Aaron Murphy, the newly minted Executive Director of Montana Conservation Voters.
Hey, Aaron, how are you?
So let's start this off by talking about climate change. Jessica, Colorado managed to stake a claim toward the end of this session to being one of the national leaders when it comes to climate. Walk us through this big climate bill that eventually got signed.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Aaron. And let me start by saying it is hard to overstate how successful and the impact of this year's legislative session in Colorado when it comes to climate and clean energy. Governor Polis, over the last couple of weeks, signed more than a dozen climate and clean energy bills into law that really puts our state at the forefront in terms of acting on climate and working against the Trump administration's rollbacks. And I can talk about a couple of those specific bills. First of all is HB 1261. That is the Colorado Climate Action Plan. And that puts goals into statute in terms of decreasing carbon pollution. So those goals are 26% reductions by 2025, 30% reductions by 2050, 50% reductions by 2030, and 90% reductions by 2050. And we are the only oil and gas producing state in the country, other than California, to have those sorts of goals in statute. So it really is quite an impressive feat here for our legislators and for the governor to sign that bill.
And what would that end up looking like in practice, in terms of reducing carbon emissions by that amount?
Yeah, that is the next step, is to implement those goals. And so that could look like a lot of different approaches. And our state regulators at the Colorado Department of Public Health and the Environment and Colorado's Air Quality Control Commission are now going to look at the ways to meet those goals. So that could be decreasing methane pollution. That could be looking at transportation. Considering that transportation is now the number one source of carbon pollution across the country. And of course, looking at our electricity sector. And we're lucky here in Colorado to have Xcel Energy, which has put its own goals in place to reduce carbon pollution by a tremendous amount. So all of those sectors will add up together, but we are going to have an implementation strategy around those goals and ensuring that the state meets them over the next several years.
All right, then let's turn to Montana. It's a different picture. Obviously, it's a coal state. Dealing with the reality of, if not an entirely post-coal future, one in which there is at least a whole lot less coal being both mined and burned. Aaron Murphy, what does that look like at the legislative level right now?
I think for a lot of legislators, Aaron, it's a reality check. This last session, there were two bills that we were very closely following that addressed the pending future that you mentioned for coal. As you may know, much of the power produced by coal in Montana used to be marketable in the Pacific Northwest and shipped out there. And we are dealing with a situation where some states in the Pacific Northwest, namely Washington and Oregon, would rather not use burned coal as their source of energy. So that has posed a lot of reality checking for legislators in Montana, where the city of Colstrip is home to a very large power plant operation that produces energy for a big chunk of the Pacific Northwest. And what we saw, one of the victories that we saw this last legislative session was Senate Bill 264. It was a pro-labor, pro-environment bill that would require coal plant owners to pay a prevailing wage to folks who work on coal remediation, demolition, should that happen, maintenance, upgrading, et cetera. It really paves the way to support the transition of Montana workers away from coal as that happens and toward a more sustainable and marketable resource-based future.
And what does that future look like? Is there a wind or a solar future in Montana?
There is, and it's actually something that has been in the works a long time. You just drive across the interstates in Montana, and you will see almost every year that you do so, more and more farms popping up, both solar and wind power. There's still a lot of work to do to really make those the dominant source of energy in the state, but I think there's a lot of recognition that it is happening. You know, the other thing that I forgot to mention was, while we're talking about coal, there was an effort in the legislature this year to throw a bone to the Colstrip plant, and specifically Northwestern Energy, which owns part of that plant. And there was one particular bill which would have carved out special sweetheart permission to our energy utility, Northwestern Energy, to bypass the oversight of the Public Service Commission, which is folks who are elected office holders in its potential purchase of Colstrip. The negative impact of this is that the ratepayers, in other words, people who live here, people like me, my neighbors, would end up subsidizing that decision with no accountability.
So, Jessica, I know that Conservation Colorado as well has been looking at what a transition looks like. Colorado still does produce a whole lot of coal power. I see the coal trains lined up along my commute into work every morning. So what does that transition look like here in the next few years?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Aaron Murphy, it's really great to hear about what Montana is doing along the lines of coal and thinking about the just transition. And one really important bill passed here in Colorado this year, which is HB 1314. And that established the first just transition office in the governor's office administration in the nation. And the goal of that office is to really lead the conversation about what impacted coal communities, both from the mining and the power plant side of things, what they need in order to thrive in a clean energy future. And so I think there's a lot of shared desire between the environmentalists and labor to really look at what that could entail. And it's great to hear about what's going on in Montana as well.
So let's go from coal to oil and gas. That took center stage at the beginning of the legislative session in Colorado. There was a big, very public fight over a bill that would give local communities set more control or more protections on oil and gas drilling. And that bill, it passed, it got signed into law, and it now has been in effect long enough that, Jessica, we're already starting to see some communities start to use that law.
Yes, that's right. And SB 181 is the bill that passed here in Colorado. And that is a tremendous, tremendous victory for those of us who have been working on oil and gas policy for many, many years here in Colorado. And it fundamentally changes how oil and gas will get done here in Colorado. So you mentioned, Aaron, that it allows local governments to have local control over various aspects of drilling. that is incredibly important. Two other things I want to point to that the bill does. One of them is it reforms our Oil and Gas Commission here. In the past, the Oil and Gas Commission's mission has been to foster the oil and gas industry. And this year, the legislature changed that to actually regulate the industry and manage it. And so that's a major, major change. And it all the bill also laid out that health and safety needs to come first when it comes to oil and gas drilling. And so a lot of new policies in place, either now or will be put in place to make sure that that happens. And then lastly, I'll just say that there were several very important changes for the environment in that bill, including some good thinking around wildlife and compensatory mitigation and what that looks like. And then the methane rule that I mentioned earlier, that was mandated by this bill as well. And that is incredibly important. So to your question, yeah, there already are some communities along the Northern Front Range in Colorado where we're really seeing this tension between oil and gas drilling and housing developments. Those communities are beginning to use that and to look at that bill. Aurora is one example, as they begin to put city and county regulations in place around oil and gas drilling.
That's I suspect on that law, then we're going to see the long-term changes over the next couple of years as that new oil and gas commission comes together. Is that right?
That's right. Yep. By mid next summer, the oil and gas commission will actually be professionalized, meaning that it won't just be a volunteer and citizen commission, but will actually be folks who are there full time. And that is a huge deal because that allows the proper amount of consideration and thought to go into regulations, into rulemakings. And I should note also that the makeup of the commission changed this year to reduce the number of industry representatives on it and added two representatives in particular, one from the wildlife community and one from the public health community. So we think that is really important.
Aaron, let me flip that bill around. And I think right now, given the makeup of the legislature in Montana, it's safe to say something like that couldn't pass in Montana in the foreseeable future. But with Montana still producing quite a bit of oil and gas, is there room to find a bipartisan solution to keep a check either both on safety and on things like methane emissions?
I think the answer is yes, because I'm an optimist and, I've been part of the political landscape that has seen some pretty, pretty bold moves looking toward the future in Montana. I would also say, though, we still have a lot of work to do to make sure that our elected leaders understand the risks and the threats that that come with that industry. So, yes, in terms of us being hopeful that it can happen in the near future, know in that, although we've had our share of victories this past legislative session, first part of this year, overall, we still have a lot of work to do within the conservation community to really apply that pressure needed to affect the change that that our world needs.
So in terms of the victories that have come, there's a nice boost to conservation funding that Montana conservation voters helped push through. What happened there?
Yeah, this was a pretty exciting bill, Senate Bill 24, for folks following at home. It's one of those bipartisan victories that was so simple. Basically, it was an easy lift for most folks, and it was championed by a Republican named Terry Gauthier, who supported the bill to fund state parks and trails and outdoor recreation and maintenance by simply increasing the voluntary motor vehicle registration donation from $6 to $9. That extra $3 per year on the folks who voluntarily want to contribute to that fund will raise another $1.8 million. And that is all set aside for parks and trails and fishing access, things that are not only good for clean water and clean air and outdoor recreation and our public lands, but also the responsible thing to do. It passed by a margin of 2-1 in this legislature, which was a very difficult thing to do. We're quite proud of that bill and proud of its champion. You know, in terms of more work to do, though, that was a very simple one. And we are in the conservation community looking at other ways to build conservation-specific funding into existing or new revenue opportunities. That is our challenge at hand. This way, we did it by tapping into an existing fee. But there are a lot of other ways that I think we could do that that will win the support of Democrats, Republicans, independents, and everyone in between. And that's most folks in Montana.
I think one of the takeaways there, obviously, is that when you ask folks, should there be more funding for conservation, the answer across the board is yes. And obviously here there's a prediction that if you ask folks, will you donate more to conservation funding, they will just check the box to do it. And I think that also gets back to conservation easements. And that's something that happened in Colorado, that conservation easement program got updated this past session. Jessica, why is that program so important, and why are these revisions or changes important?
Yeah, well, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about public lands policy, both on this podcast and other places, and absolutely public lands are critical to protecting ecosystems and climate and human health, but some of us spend less time thinking about private lands and the importance of protecting them as well. And so the conservation easement program really focuses on the private lands that deserve to be protected. And so what this bill does here in Colorado is it reauthorizes an important tax credit program in order to give a financial incentive to protect private acres of land. It increases the program transparency, and it also tightens up some governance issues around the program. So, you know, this was one of a bipartisan compromise bill, which was really important and great to see this collaboration between private landowners and conservation groups as well. So we're really excited about this bill.
There were also, of course, several very bad bills, particularly in Montana, that either didn't make it out of the legislature or were vetoed by the governor. I was fascinated to see on your scorecard, Aaron, a bill would have made it harder to create conservation easements. And that just kind of had me scratching my head that was even in the mix.
Yeah, that bill is it's definitely one that we were watching quite closely, and it was brought forward by Representative Kerry White of Bozeman. Notably, he runs an organization called Citizens for Balanced Use, which is an organization that doesn't see eye to eye with us when it comes to public lands and how they should be used and what kind of access should be granted to them. Nonetheless, what his bill would have done would have required the state land board. And just for folks who may be unaware, our land board is our top five elected seats in the state. So that consists of the governor, the attorney general, the secretary of state, the superintendent of public instruction, and the auditor. Those five positions make up the board to make big decisions that affect Montana's public lands. Anyway, what the bill would have done would required that board to approve all conservation easements on private land through a state program called Habitat Montana. And what that would have done was give politicians the power to prevent landowners from the right to conserve their own property. It was a very irresponsible bill. Luckily, our governor, Governor Steve Bullock, saw that. He vetoed it. And by the way, Habitat Montana has helped conserve over 350,000 acres of wildlands and habitat since its existence. So very successful thing. We are proud of the fact that our governor stood in the way of an effort by what we consider special interests to make it a lot more difficult, as you said, Aaron, for folks to preserve their own land.
Question for both of you. Just take us behind the scenes during a legislative session. I know they're crazy. You've got tons going on, bills on everything from conservation to vaccines to whatever else. How nuts is it? And give us a little peek behind the curtain on how the sausage gets made.
Well, I can kick it off, Aaron. And I'd say a couple of things here. First of all, you know, this year in Colorado, we have a Democratic trifecta, a pro-conservation trifecta. for the first time in several years. And so there was a lot of consideration of different priorities, a tremendous amount of issues to be thinking about and that legislators were hearing about all the time. So certainly a lot happened, not just on conservation and environmental issues, but across the board. And so then a question that all of our groups are asking ourselves is, how do we ensure that these issues are a priority? And, you know, here in Colorado, one thing I would say is that what makes it possible for us to do the work that we did this year is that Colorado voters really prioritize the environment, and they have made that clear. So as just one example, there was a survey taken right after the election last year in November 2018, and it was a survey of unaffiliated voters who comprise a third of our electorate here. And when asked a spread of issues and when asked which of these issues was most important in your vote for governor, those unaffiliated voters answered that the environment was their number one issue. And so I think that that message, in a lot of ways, we voters put elected officials into office because of the work that they promised to do on climate change and clean energy and conservation. And in a lot of ways, it was a mandate, which is why we saw those legislators and Governor Polis deliver in such a powerful way here.
And Aaron, it must have been getting thrown into the fire for you. A little bit of background, you were most recently chief of staff to Senator John Tester, so you've got a whole lot of experience on the federal level, but all of a sudden getting thrown into the mix on the state level must have been quite an experience for you.
Yeah. And luckily, I had the benefit of working for a U.S. senator who began his career in public service in the Montana legislature. He was a state senator for 8 years, including president of the Montana Senate. So I learned a lot from him. And then seeing how the sausage was made just in the past few months was no surprise, but it is quite interesting. And I'm sure this is true in other states as well, but you know, Montana is a state where people really have an influence and a lot of say in what their elected leaders do in the citizen legislature. So accountability really works in this state. If there are constituents who are upset or riled up about something or need to communicate a message to their leaders, their leaders will most likely sit down and respectfully listen to them. So that is the benefit that we've got in our state, which is huge geographically, but very small in terms of population. We're just over 1 million people statewide. The other thing that we did in terms of making the sausage, which I want to share because it's, I think, a very effective strategy, but we are part of a larger group of advocacy organizations called the Conservation Working Group. So other folks who share a lot of our same goals. And we have strength in numbers within that group. And every week during the legislative session, we would send all legislators a hot list of where the conservation community stands on certain bills and other decision points during the week. And that was a very effective strategy because the lawmakers, you know, clearly some of them don't care what we think, but a lot of them do. And a lot of them were at least curious for our take on them as they made those decisions. I think we did a very good job of pointing out the economic value of conservation work, protecting clean air and clean water and public lands and fighting climate change. In a state like Montana, like Colorado, that has direct impacts on people's pocketbooks. We are part of an economy that enjoys $7.1 billion in economic activity every year through outdoor recreation, 70,000 direct Montana jobs, which is overwhelmingly more than jobs produced in other sectors. So once we start talking about these issues in those economic terms, people start listening and they start voting based on what we're telling them because they know it to be true. So those are a couple things that we did just in the past few months to bend the ear of the citizen legislature here.
I want to touch on both of your respective governors. Jessica, Jared Polis just took office in Colorado, and based on what happened here, it seems like he is eager to lead on conservation issues. So what are you looking at going into the future or down to the next legislative session?
Yes, absolutely. Governor Polis ran on a platform of 100% renewables by 2040 and also what he called his Keep Colorado Wild platform. And so our conservation and environmental issues were very much at the forefront of his campaign. And that's why we were so thrilled to see him sign all these bills into law and to deliver. So we'll be watching several things moving forward. The first of those is implementation of these bills that we've discussed here. So what exactly does implementation of the climate and clean energy bills that got passed look like? And the oil and gas bill as well. The governor also has opportunity to appoint folks to various boards and commissions who will be implementing some of that policy and that work. So we'll be watching that. And then we'll be watching moving forward the what the governor does in terms of his executive power and with his agencies. So everything from wildlife corridors, wildlife conservation, all the way to the Colorado Water Plan and ensuring that we have enough funding for that. So a tremendous amount of work was done here in Colorado this session, but we have a tremendous amount more work to do. And Governor Polis certainly is well positioned, and I think is a great person to be leading the way on that.
And then, Aaron, it's the opposite situation in Montana. Steve Bullock nearing the end of his term. He's running for president. A lot of folks hope he changes his mind and runs for Senate instead. Let's put that aside and just ask, what's Steve Bullock's conservation legacy?
It's one to be very proud of, Aaron. Steve Bullock came right out of the gate on the conservation agenda. He adopted an energy blueprint, which has more than doubled the state's solar and energy production. He has done a very good job holding corporate polluters accountable across the state. He negotiated a cleanup of a Superfund site in Butte, Montana, which if you've ever been through Butte, you've seen that Superfund site. It is obvious. He sued to implement Montana's bad actor provisions. A couple of years ago, he created the Office of Outdoor Recreation, which is its own new office within the state government, specifically devoted to expanding opportunities that go hand in hand with preserving the heritage that we need to keep that outdoor recreation strong. He led a multi-state effort with Western governors to ensure effective management of the greater sage grouse. He established Forests and Focus, which is a program to encourage healthy forests and responsible fuel reduction. It really is a long list, and that's just a glimpse of it. But it's something that he has taken by the horns and wrestled to the ground. And it's also something that's a good reminder to us as we look ahead to Montana's next governor. As the world changes quickly and urgently, we will need a governor who understands what Governor Bullock did in Montana, and more importantly, have the courage to act on them forcefully and quickly.
All right. I know Jessica has to get going, so I want to give Jessica the last word here, because it was obviously a very successful legislative session. We haven't even touched on all the bills that Conservation Colorado worked on that passed. So I want to ask you finally to name off some of what successfully got through this year that you think are ripe for export. What should other states be looking at if Colorado is a leader for the rest of the country on conservation issues?
Yeah, so I wanted to note two other bills that got passed this year that we're really proud of, and those will have to do with water. The first is around hard rock mining, which is an issue that we face here in Colorado and many states across the West that have a legacy of hard rock mining also face. And so a bill that was passed this year would work to ensure that hard rock mining companies were held financially responsible for the costs associated with water quality treatment, and that also to prevent the perpetual water treatment. And so the idea of that is to ensure that we have we don't have large abandoned and polluting mines into the future. So I think there's a lot of work that we Western states can do on the hard rock mine issue. We took a small but important and good step in that direction. And the second bill that I'll note is a bill that passed in the very final days of the legislative session, and that bill is to legalize sports betting, which you might say, why is that a conservation bill? So allow people to gamble and bet on their favorite sports teams and the Denver Broncos. But the reason is because that money will be directed to water and to Colorado's water plan, which we're really excited about. That is technically a referred measure. And so voters will be able to vote on that in 2019 here this November. But this questioning you're just discussing around conservation funding, we have really important work to do around funding on lands and wildlife, but there's also really important funding needs around water. So in a state like Colorado, where we have some pretty severe limits on our spending, being creative about finding that money to support these important programs is really important to us. So we are pleased to see that bill pass.
Wow. All right. So I guess we will leave that there with the gambling connection to conservation funding as the idea to leave in everyone's heads. Jessica Goad is Deputy Director at Conservation Colorado. Aaron Murphy is the Executive Director at Montana Conservation Voters. Thanks so much to both of you for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
All right, let's take a look back at this week in Western history. Our story starts in 1976, shortly after the death of the reclusive billionaire Howard Hughes. A handwritten will was discovered in all places on the steps of the headquarters of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Salt Lake City. The will claimed to have been written and signed by Howard Hughes in March of 1968. It was riddled with grammar and spelling errors, and among the many oddities, it gave 1/16 of his fortune to the LDS Church and 1/16 to someone named Melvin Dumar, D-U-M-A-R, of Gabbs, Nevada. So who the heck is Melvin Dumar? Well, it didn't take reporters long to find a Melvin Dumar, D-U-M-M-A-R, who owned a gas station in Willard, Utah. And boy, did Melvin have quite the story to tell. He said that in December of 1967, he was driving through the Nevada desert when he stopped to relieve himself. And that is when he spotted a man lying on the ground bleeding. He was thin and disheveled with long hair and a scruffy beard. Melvin said he assumed the guy was a bum, in his own words, but he asked the guy where he wanted to go, and he said the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas. So Melvin, as the story goes, drove the guy to Vegas, gave him a few bucks, and dropped him off behind the hotel. Only in those last few minutes, Dumar said, did the man reveal he was Howard Hughes. And after Howard Hughes died, Melvin told reporters that he had no idea about that will that turned up on the church headquarters, giving him what would have been more than $150 million of Hughes' estate. But that's when the story started to unravel. Police found Dumar's fingerprint on the envelope. So Dumar then changed his story and said that a well-dressed man, who he described as a confidential agent of Howard Hughes, had left the will in a sealed envelope at his gas station and told him to deliver it to the church. Oh, and then he admitted that he'd actually steamed open the envelope to look at its contents. The so-called Mormon will ended up in a probate trial in 1978, and things fell apart quickly from there. In addition to the misspellings on almost every line, it named a former employee of Hughes's as the executor of the estate, even though that guy had left Hughes on bad terms back in the 50s. It left money to Howard Hughes's two ex-wives, even though both of them already had alimony settlements that barred them from making claims on his estate. And perhaps most telling, it called Howard Hughes's famous flying boat the Spruce Goose, and Howard Hughes hated that nickname. Well, it turned out that Melvin Dumar's wife, Bonnie, had worked for a magazine called Millionaire that was mailed to wealthy Americans, and that meant she would have had access to Howard Hughes's memo and signatures. Now, she denied having anything to do with the will, but on June 8th, 1978, a Nevada jury ruled that the Mormon will was a forgery. Melvin Dumar got nothing, but he was also never charged with a crime. So Jonathan Demme, of all people, the director, went on to make a movie about this whole crazy tale called Melvin and Howard. It actually won a couple of Oscars and was nominated for several more on top of that. Melvin Dumar even has a cameo in it. And that might be where this story ends. But then in 2005, a retired FBI agent wrote a book that actually backed up some of Dumar's story. That agent said that some of Howard Hughes's closest employees remembered him
entering the Sands Hotel one morning in December 1967, saying he'd been picked up by a guy driving through the desert. Hughes apparently was a regular customer at a brothel in the area, and he had mining interests nearby. So, based on that book, Melvin Dumas went back to court, claiming the biggest beneficiaries of Howard Hughes' estate had conspired to defraud him of his rightful share and concealed evidence at that trial in 1978. Well, it didn't work. A judge dismissed the lawsuit, saying that the whole thing had been fairly litigated the first time around. Melvin Dumas just died this past December in Pahrump, Nevada. He was 74 years old. He never saw a dime of Howard Hughes' estate, but he did earn himself an obituary in the Washington Post as one of the oddest footnotes to one of the oddest lives in American history. That post obit closes with a quote from a doo-wop song Dumas recorded in the 80s as he tried unsuccessfully to cash in on his fame. The lyrics went in part, "Thank you, Howard, for leaving me something. All you left me was frustration, and I'll never live it down. How I wish you weren't around. Only you know what went down." That is the bitter legacy of a trial that ended in Nevada 41 years ago this week in Western history. That is all I've got for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. Don't forget, we will see you on Monday the 10th in Vail to say hi to David Bernhardt. And keep those suggestions for our summer podcast tour coming, podcast@westernpriorities.org, or just drop me a direct message on Twitter where I am A. Weiss. Thanks again to Jessica Goad from Conservation Colorado and Aaron Murphy from Montana Conservation Voters for their time this week. We will be back in a couple weeks with an episode from the floor of the big outdoor retailer summer show. Don't be a stranger if you're in Denver for that. And as always, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or share this episode with a friend if you enjoyed it. I'm Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of the entire team here at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.
What'd you say your name was?
Dumas. Melvin.
You're kidding me, Mel.